Talking Business on Radio Q. Joining me now is Tony Kavanagh, Director of Anthony G. Kavanagh and Company, Bloodstock Agents. G'day, Tony. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Now, tell us how you got started as a bloodstock agent.
Well, I first went along our local butcher when I was growing up in North Melbourne, won a race at Moonee Valley, and I was intrigued by that. So I started to go to the races.
When was this?
1960.
Right.
And then I started to go to the horse sales.
And how old were you? You were a teenager.
14, 13, going on 14.
Yeah, right.
And I was just absorbed with the pedigrees. I wasn't interested in gambling. And I just kept going, and I'd try and commit to memory what the horses looked like, swatted up on the catalogues. This is all pre-computers. And I left school in the mid-60s.
And understood, you basically got to know horse pedigrees, did
pedigrees,
you?
Pedigrees, yeah. It was just fascinating.
And what was involved in understanding horse pedigrees?
Well, you had to have a good memory for a start off, and then you'd
and so is the bloodlines of a particular horse.
Yeah, both on the male and the female, and then watching progeny come along and trying to find out about characteristics. And then you start to meet people, and it just went from there. And
it obviously was a passion of yours.
Absolutely.
In your teens. Were you able to turn that into a livelihood at the time?
Oh, no. So I left school and I studied land valuation for a few years, which I love that, but there were no opportunities to get cadetships. And then all of a sudden there was an opportunity came up, and I became the assistant secretary of the Racecourses Licences Board in 1968. So this is the time of Sir Arthur Ryler, Sir John Dillon, Sir Henry Bolte. So great political people and great racing men. And that brought me closer to racing. And then the horse auction company, Wright Stevenson and Company, where I'd been going all along, a vacancy occurred there. I got involved. I started to compile pedigrees. And I was on the original black type subcommittee in Australia, and we evolved a new style of pedigree. And that's where I sort of gained the reputation, and I left after 8 years there, 1978.
Set up your own business then?
No, I went to a big stud, and at that stage in the development of the industry, you'd either had an owner-occupier or an absentee owner who had a physical person doing all the work. But I went in the middle, and there'd never been anyone like that, so they call me an administration manager now. There's a plethora of all sorts of farm managers and whatnot. And then I did that for a year and had some high-profile racing people there, including Mark Redd, the bookmaker. And
were there a lot of bloodstock experts around at the time?
No,
when you kind of learned it all, were you one of the few?
Yes, there are only a handful, and there are two, auction houses, which people had a chance to sell or else to sell privately. It was very different then, and also the media wasn't as intense as what it is now. We were still, I think, at that stage, we hadn't developed as much as an industry. Still, there weren't things like a lot of national situations, and so then I set up my business after a year with Mark Reed in 1980.
Mark Reed is
the bookmaker, the very flamboyant bookmaker, 79-80. And so that's for the last 37 years. So
is horse pedigree as simple as getting somebody who used to win races and getting their progeny?
Oh, no. There's a lot more there's a lot more to it than that. And now it's very global. And we've seen, there's always been horses imported from previous century and whatnot, but now Australia is a very vibrant player on the global scene. And even though we had in Sol Green won the Melbourne Cup in 1910 with a foal, he imported in 1906 Comedy King, but when Vintage Crop won in 1993, I think that turned the tables.
Why? What was that about?
Well, he flew in. Always the enemy from an Australian point of view were the Kiwis, because they'd come over and plunder our riches, and because they had great stayers there. But then all of a sudden, Dermot Weld, who's an absolute genius, probably the greatest mind of anyone I've ever met in racing, and had been a great traveller of horses throughout the rest of the world, he'd come out as a young guy and worked with Tommy Smith. He was a vet who never practised. And it was a real, had a global outlook. And the previous year they tried to break down and change the quarantine laws, and they gave up 6 weeks earlier, and he had just the featherweight, and he would have won by the length of the straight the year before. But that he became a legendary sort of figure, and then he was placed and another time, came out here three times, and then the other raiders start coming out, and now we see it's quite unbelievable what's happened.
Now, Tony's brought in a whip, which I'll hold close to the microphone so everyone can see it.
There's your sense of humour again.
Now, it's an old whip. You better tell us the story. Why did you bring this in? And
well, I just wanted to set the stage.
It's a very nice-looking whip. It looks like it... they give you a bit of a sting on the rump there.
Well, it would. Gary Murphy, who's now retired, and he was in Ballarat. He rode Let's Get Physical for me, and Robert Smurden, who I met 42 years ago and mentored, and he was the youngest trainer to win a Blue Diamond at 29. And it was by a stallion that I'd bought, O&J Star, named after Livy Newton-John, and then I bred Let's Get Physical. And it was a great victory for the underdog, and Gary had come back from the dead on a couple of occasions, racing and car accident and whatnot. And Lester Piggott, the world-famous Lester Piggott, was out here, and he rode Acumen, who ran second. So that whip was of great assistance in winning the Blue Diamond. And, yeah, so you got a history of the turf. And I think I love the turf and the history and all that, you know.
Is it possible to create a Melbourne Cup winner through breeding? Or do you just kind of go by luck?
Oh, no. It's you've got obviously both by the sire and the dam, and then you'll find some stallions sire sprinting type progeny or middle distance. Others really excel with stayers, and you find also with a lot of the European horses that have come out, they have a totally different program with the way they prepare the horses. They lightly race them. And they race on for a long while. So there are some dominant staying standards, and in recent years you've seen the influence of a lot of German.
What I mean is, could you say, listen, I want to, in 10 years' time, I'm going to have a Melbourne Cup winner and I'm going to breed horses to achieve that. Can you do that?
Well, you can attempt to breed stayers. At the end of the day, you might breed a stayer, but then it's also about the class, you know.
That's right.
There. So it's a whole lot of factors, and you've got to look at the female side of things and who's trained it, how it's been reared. It's a lot of variable and a lot of luck too. And so when you talk about that, if you're an outsider and you're looking on at the racing industry and you see someone waving and cheering and clapping after a huge victory, you would never, ever begrudge them, because you know behind that there's been a lifetime.
I'm just kind of wondering whether it's like Formula One racing, in the sense that, you know, they sort of create the car.
Yeah, no,
obviously,
no,
you've got to get
quite
a good driver, yeah, but the car is, in a sense, created, and it's about how good the car is.
You can strive for that, but look, if there was a magical formula, the wealthiest four or five people in the world would just own everything. And so there's all these variables all the time that brings everyone back to the field, and then you've got weight.
Well, it's obviously kept you fascinated through a lifetime, Tony.
It has, yes.
And tell us about how the business works. What do you do? I mean, how do you make a living as a bloodstock agent?
Well, say someone like yourself might come to me, you might want to get into racing, you might have a few mates, you might want to get a filly to race and breed.
Might have some money I want to throw away.
Well, I didn't say that. Or you might, as I say, aspire to have a Melbourne Cup winner. Or, you know, so
right,
you would come to me and we'd work out what your budget was and did you have a preferred trainer in mind, and by a process of elimination we'd come to a conclusion that you can have a horse trained in the city, you want to have a horse trained in Melbourne. And you've got $100,000 or whatever you've got to spend. And then so we will go searching for that, and we'd look at either a yearling, or we might look at buying into an existing horse that, you know, might buy metaphorically a leg of a horse that's already up and running, a four-year-old, a five-year-old, that could be a contender, or we might buy 10 or 20.
And you'd advise on the breeding of that horse.
Yes.
And whether the breeding is
good about enough, the potential of the horse and whatnot, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so, and how far back do some of these bloodlines go?
Oh, they go back, man.
They go
centuries.
Back centuries.
Yeah. But
And do you have to study them all that far back?
Oh, no. You're looking at it more in the last few generations, but in particular the last couple of generations, to see if the family is dying on the vine, if there's a lot of activity in the family, what are the progeny in those first couple of dams doing? Are they as friends as other stayers, are the fillies in the family race better than the colts? Or whatever, you know. So there's
What's the greatest horse that you've come across in your time, would you say? What's the horse that stands out most for you?
I was a young guy, Tullock, but Kingston Town and Vane were right up there. And now, obviously, you've got in the modern-day situation with Winx, you know. And it's good to have these figurehead horses because that attracts people to the races and want to get people involved. And now with syndication, you know, it's broken down the barriers for the entree into racing for people. So it's such a level playing field, you know. At the age of 90 or 100, you can be competing at the top level, whereas if you're an athlete, well, you might peak at 20 or 30, you know. So it's and the passing parade, like life is one thing, but the passing parade per media of what happens to you in racing is another thing. And because of the characters and the diverse people who come in.
Characters such as you, Tony. Great to talk to you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Alan.
I've been talking to Tony Kavanagh, a director of Anthony G. Kavanagh and Company, Bloodstock Agents.